recap, especially for our visitors. We have been studying the subject of afterlife, what then? And our intentions is to talk about death, second coming, the resurrection, judgment, and heaven and hell. And I'm supposed to have this all done by the end of June, and we're still talking about death. Hopefully we'll get that taken care of today. That's my intentions anyway, to finish covering that. And we already discussed, you know, well, why do we die? And the subject went from there. And last week, as we finished up, we asked the question, what do we know about the afterlife? And I had just mentioned that there are several stories that you can get on the internet about people who have supposedly clinically died and then came back to life. And some of the things they've seen, they say everything went completely black. Many described seeing bright lights. Others felt like they were in a tube. Some described a feeling of incredible peace. And then the last question I asked, wouldn't we all like to have known Lazarus? And been interesting to see the questions that Mary and Martha asked Lazarus after he was raised from the dead. And the Bible doesn't give us any thoughts on that. And so I'm sure that that's well and good, because the Bible gives us everything that we need to know. Of course, we've already talked about in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew words. The word Sheol is used for the place that you go after you die, and that was used 65 times in the New American Standard Bible, 18 times in the New King James Version, and 0 in the NIV. Other words that were used in place of Sheol is the grave or the pit. Okay, so we've read scripture like that. Sheol is defined as the unseen world, the state or abode of the dead. And that's equivalent to the Greek word Hades. And that the word Hades is translated in the Septuagint. I'm going to give you an example where this word Sheol is used. In the story of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, we remember that they were of the opinion that Moses was exalting himself above many in the congregation. And they considered themselves just like, we're just as holy as you are. Why can't we be the leader? So in Numbers, the 16th chapter, verse 23, 24, and then 28 through 33, here's what it says. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, say to the congregation, get away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Moses said, hereby you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, and that it has not been of my own accord. If these men die as all men die, or if they are visited by the fate of all mankind, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates something new, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all their belongings to them, and they go down alive into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord. And of course, as the story goes on, as soon as they finished speaking these words, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their household and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. So Sheol is this place that they all referred to that you went after you died. Now, in the New Testament, Vine defines Hades as the region of departed spirits of the lost. Okay, so really, it's not any difference in the definition that we got from Sheol, the unseen world, the state or abode of the dead. Vine includes in this, in parentheses, it says, but including the blessed dead in the periods preceding the ascension of Christ. We'll be talking about that, I think, a little bit later on. The word Hades is used How many times in the Gospels do you know? Anybody have a guess? I found it was four times used in the Gospels, and it was used by the Lord all four times. Matthew 11 and 23, Jesus was referring to Capernaum not being exalted to heaven, but brought down to Hades. Okay, and then there was some talk there, you remember, about Sodom and Gomorrah. Matthew 16 and 18 referencing the gates of Hades not prevailing against the rock and chief cornerstone, of course, being Christ, the one who established the church. Luke 10 and 15 is a repeat about Capernaum. Luke 16 and 23, the place where the rich man presided after death. And we will be getting into that story a little bit later on here. So in Acts 2:27 and Acts 2:31, it uses the word to reference the soul of Christ not being left there. If you remember that verse about Christ's soul not being left in Hades. The Old King James, what word would have been used in the Old King James in place of Hades? Hell, yes. And the word hell is actually got different meanings, but it'd be more accurate to speak of this as Hades. Christ declared that he had the keys or the control of this place called Hades. That's in Revelations 1 and 18. In Revelation 6 and 8, Hades is personified as the temporary destiny of the doomed. And then in Revelations 20 and 13, it says that Hades is to give up those that are therein. In Revelations 20 and 14, it is to be, Hades is also to be cast into the lake of fire. All these, this subject matter we'll be getting into later on in the study. So, I ask you this question. How much can we know about this place of departed spirits? This place that we've defined, Sheol or Hades. What can we know about that? Well, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when you think about knowing about Hades? Where would you look in the Bible? Just give me a general. You don't have to give me the specific scripture, but what story comes to your mind when you think about? Yes, rich man and Lazarus. Very good, and that's what we're gonna look at right now. That's in Luke 16th chapter, verse 19 through 31. I suppose that's our best help that we have. Some may dispute that, but I think that's the best help that we have on this subject. Now, this passage is debated by many whether or not it's a true life story or is it a parable. And I personally think it's a parable. Many people say, well, it's not like other parables don't mention names of people. Okay, so that's one reasoning why some people say, I think it's a true life story. Well, let me ask you this. Does it really make a difference if it's a true life story or it's a parable? What difference does it make? I think we get the point when we read the story. I think we understand that there is going to be a place. Okay.
Well, if it was a parable, it would have some meaning other than just what you read. Because parables did have. If it was just a story, then it would mean what you read. Might be one way.
Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts or comments about that? Well, let's just look at some of the facts, and you can kind of decide. First of all, we need to understand a little bit about what was going on prior to this chapter 16. Chapter 15, Jesus is speaking to tax collectors and sinners. The Pharisees are always standing by. You know, they're jealous, and they're watching all these gatherings around Jesus. And naturally, they don't like what they see. The Pharisees and scribes are observing these gatherings, and they're grumbling and upset with the company of Jesus is keeping. All right, you know, he's over there with the tax collectors, or look how he's with the sinners. and et cetera and so on. And then in this particular chapter, he tells three parables pertaining to sinners repenting. So the subject matter is parables in chapter 15. Then in chapter 16, Jesus continues teaching his disciples. Okay, and who are his disciples? Tax collectors and sinners. That's who was following him. All right, so it tells us in chapter 16 that he continues to teach his disciples. And he's teaching them about the danger of loving money more than doing what is righteous. Okay, what do we know about rich people? What's the chances of rich people making it to heaven?
Less.
Less is right. And it almost seems like a lot less, doesn't it? We get the description, one of the scriptures that says it's easier to go through the eye of the needle than for a rich man to go to heaven. Okay, I mean, I have said that exactly right, but I think I got the right gist there. So, I want you to notice how chapter 16 starts out. It starts out, really, just pretty much like chapter 15. It says, there was a certain rich man. Well, some of the parables that were mentioned in chapter 15 starts out like that too. Or excuse me, I may be saying that wrong. At the beginning of I'm a little mixed up on that. At the beginning of chapter 16, it starts out and it says there was a certain rich man, and then when we get down to the story about Lazarus, it says there was a certain rich man. So it starts out the same way that the parable started out. So that's just something for us to know. So it begins and says, there was a certain rich man. And from there, Jesus tells a parable of a rich man who decides to fire an unfaithful manager. You remember this guy, he wasn't managing the money properly. And so his boss basically says, I'm going to get rid of you. And, of course, that's the story where the guy then tries to figure out, well, this is kind of the only work I know. I mean, I can't dig. I'm using paraphrasing, but I can't dig ditches. I can't go out there and do physical work. What am I going to do? And then if you remember, he kind of made a deal with some of the people that owed him, and he just collected just part of the money and thought that was better than nothing. Okay, we're not going to get into that parable, but you know the story I'm talking about. So anyway, the Pharisees, as they're listening to these things that Jesus is speaking, they become quite perturbed. And why do they become perturbed? Yes, they were lovers of money, and they perceived that Jesus was talking about them. Okay? They didn't like being in the spotlight. Well, they perceived this, and what is this? It's their conscience, isn't it? You know, the Bible says your conscience will either accuse you or excuse you. That's in Romans 2:15. And I think that's exactly what's happening here. They're listening to Jesus speaking and they don't like it. So as Jesus concludes the parable, he says in Luke 16:12, he says, and if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and man. Okay, so you can't be a lover of money, as Theda says that they were, and be a lover of God at the same time. One of them's got to have precedence. The Pharisees, Luke verse 14, it says, the Pharisees who were lovers of money heard all these things and they ridiculed him. And so Jesus replied, you are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your heart, for what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God. In James 5th chapter verse 1, it says, come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. And then verse 5 says, you have lived on the earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fatted your hearts in the day of slaughter. And that's what the next parable is going to be about. Then Jesus continues his teaching. In verse 19, he says, there was a rich man, And from this point on, he shares a real life story, or else a parable, of two men of both living in opposing lives. Okay? One's rich, one's poor. One who could have used some help, a helping hand, and then the one who selflessly took care of himself. Then there's the poor man named Lazarus, and he was considered to be righteous, and there was the rich man who was considered to be unrighteous. Now, in how many ways was he unrighteous? I don't know. He might have gave money to lots of organizations and people and did lots of philanthropy. Who knows? We don't know. We don't know that much about him. But we do know this, that somebody right outside his door needed help, and he wasn't able to see it or ignored it and could care less. And for that, he was considered unrighteous. After they died, as the story goes, after they died, both their spirits were escorted to a waiting place for the spirits of humankind. Who escorted Lazarus to this waiting place? What?
Angels.
Who escorted the rich man to his waiting place? Doesn't say, does it? You know, I suppose that it might be safe to assume that angels escorted him to his place too. But it doesn't say that. It just says he died and was buried. Okay? But we do know that angels escorted Lazarus to his waiting place. Now, Lazarus, it says, was in the bosom of Abraham. So being in this close proximity, we can assume that they were both in paradise, where Jesus and one of the two thieves who hung on the cross next to Jesus went after they died. Because we know in Luke 23 and 43, it gives the account of Jesus making mention that today you will be with me in paradise. Okay, now, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But here's how this story continues. Luke chapter 16, verse 23, it says, "And in Hades, being in torment, he lifted up his eyes," talking about the rich man, "and saw Abraham afar off and Lazarus at his side. And he called out, 'Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame.' But Abraham said, 'Child, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, and Lazarus, in like manner, bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish.'" So the tables have turned. Now, this is just a thought I'm going to throw out there. So would you rather be hurt for a little short period of time or a long period of time? Well, it's pretty obvious that if you get some kind of a sickness or disease or injury, it's not very pleasant, but it sure beats being like that the rest of your life, isn't it? Okay, so that's why we go to doctors and physicians, is to get help and to get rid of our pain and suffering and to heal up. Well, Lazarus was in a lot of suffering for a short period of time compared to the rest of his being, because then in eternity, he's going to be in a place of comfort. And the other fella is going to be in a place of anguish. So, as the story goes on, he says, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus to dip the end of the finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame." It's kind of interesting that he doesn't ask Abraham to send me back. He says, "Send Lazarus back to tell him." I think he's so used to having servants and people waiting on him that I guess he still thinks he's got a little leverage. I don't know. But he says, well, send Lazarus back send Lazarus over to dip his finger in water. And then he also requests that Lazarus be sent to go tell his brothers about this place. So I'm getting ahead of myself. But anyway, verse 24, he says, I am in anguish in this flame. But Abraham says to him, child, remember that you in your lifetime received your good things and Lazarus in the manner of bad things. Besides all this, between us is a great chasm has been fixed in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able and none may cross from there to us. Okay. Now, so if it was a parable, okay, we're telling a story that we can imagine. We can imagine this great gulf or chasm, you know. You can't jump across. It's too wide to jump across. And you sure can't go down in it and come back up. Okay? It says you can't cross. You can't come over here and we can't go over there. All right? So as you think about everything that's been said, and you might help me along the way, but I'll list some things that I noticed in the story. This is a residing place for spirits and not bodies. Okay, we get that impression that this is a place for spirits. Obviously, this place is divided by a great chasm into a realm of one side is comfort and the other side is agony. In this particular place, it appears as though one can see and speak there because the rich man is seeing afar off. He sees Abraham and Lazarus in his bosom, and he's speaking, he's talking there. Obviously, there's no room service there. No one's serving another one. Okay, no one can cross the great chasm of separation. Presumably, no one can leave there. Or else the rich man, I suppose, would have went back and warned his brothers himself. But he's stuck. There's no place for him to go. And obviously, the one in agony can remember the past since he wanted Abraham to send Lazarus back to the living to give them a warning. And of course, he wants Lazarus to go back. Why do you think Abraham refused to send Lazarus back? We have the answer. What is the answer? Yeah, it wouldn't do any good. Well, why would you listen to a poor beggarly guy that laid at a gate with sores all over him, the dogs licking him? Why would you listen to him when you wouldn't listen to the prophets of the Lord? The mighty prophets of God. You wouldn't listen to them. So why would you listen to this guy? So I'm not gonna do that. Okay? Now,
it also would defeat the principle that we're taught throughout the Bible that when your human body dies, nothing, you cannot change your eternal destiny.
Okay.
Because if Lazarus could go back, then would he be saved again? You know, we know that he was raised from the dead once, and by Jesus. He had to die again, but apparently, he didn't ever reach his final destination, or he wouldn't have been brought back.
So, are you? If I'm reading you right, you're thinking that this Lazarus is the same Lazarus that God raised from the dead?
Well, I just assumed that it was. It may not be.
Well, it's funny that you said that because I never assumed that it ever was. But then, as I thought about the story, I thought, you know what? I wonder if this is the Lazarus that got raised from the dead, you know, by Jesus.
Well, whether he was or not, it's really not the point. The point was that once you die, your fate is sealed.
Right. Right. You're not going to change anything. You can't change anything. Now, obviously, the rich man has the desire to help his brothers whom What kind of example did the rich man leave for his brothers? I think he knows exactly what he taught his brothers. And he's thinking, uh-oh, they're going to end up in the same place I am. And somebody's got to go back and tell them, you got to change. Because you don't want to come to where I'm at. And it's like, why? They're not going to listen. Right here, Dwayne, or Theta. Exactly right. And we'll be talking about judgment later on, hopefully.
Well, the thing that kind of struck me on this is I struggle with this whole physical versus the spiritual. You made a comment here that these are spiritual beings, but yet they're experiencing physical things. The pain and the anguish, the thirst that he had. And so...
talks about flames.
Yeah, flames. So... even in death, there's some type of a physical body as well that experiences these physical things. And I think that there's also this spiritual pain that's much greater than the physical, but I'm having a tough time kind of separating the two, both in death and in life.
Right. Right here, Dwayne.
Just in kind of what we're talking about, it's always been my idea that, and I, one way I think, look at this as a parable, but then I'm kind of thinking it's a real story.
Okay.
We're talking about real things that really happen. You know,
right.
Mike said we don't have to compare it to something else.
Right.
So, well, I don't know if there is anything we can compare it to. As far as, I think, I've always looked at Hades as being a two-part place.
Right.
It's a place, it's abode of the dead. Okay, that's where all the dead go, but there's two places there. And one is what we call paradise, the other is what we call Hades, or I guess, I don't know about the names because I know, but there are those two, the place for the good and for the bad. And that kind of goes along with what we read in
right.
the story here.
Right.
And there's a great gulf, but they can talk. And talk back and forth, you know, kind of like Eric. Well, you know, I think they died because they buried the rich man, so it wasn't his physical body. But there is some kind of a spiritual body. It's not flesh and blood, I don't think. But it does have the mind. It has thoughts. It can think and it can communicate and do all of those things. So. It starts really getting
comfy
for me.
So we can't take everything here as, I don't think exactly as it's written. For instance, when Jesus says in he's quoting Abraham, verse 26, says, those who would want to pass from here to you cannot. Well, who would want to go there?
Well,
it's just a figure of speech to describe the fact that they're not leaving either place.
Yeah.
That's not possible.
Well, now, let's just say you were on the side of paradise and you could see one of your relatives over there, you might want to go over there and try to rescue him.
Well,
you know, I'm saying that, in other words, just that.
Purpose, but to go there to stay, nobody.
Well, no, nobody was going to want to do that.
It's just not possible to leave.
Yeah, and obviously, if you're on the place of torment, you would love to be over on the other side if you could get there. James? Right.
And all of our chances are here and now. But I was wondering, as far as this, we know that they remember the past from the story, and if the mind is still active and working, then they would remember. It might be a psychological thing, I guess, is what I'm getting at, that he thinks he's thirsty, and he understands that the flame is bad. I mean, hot.
Right.
Because if you talk to somebody who's had their leg amputated, they have phantom pain and an appendix that they no longer have.
Right.
And so it could be a psychological pain or a pain such as that they're experiencing because they remember what they suffered in life. So it may not be a physical body, to Dwayne's point.
Right. It's a spirit.
That we're talking about. But body or the mind, the spirit would still understand that there was pain and what it was like.
Yeah. It's just, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you want to throw something else in there? So if there is no pain in paradise, no sorrow, then what about the people that made it and they look over and see their wife and their husband or their children who didn't make it? Well, then, you know, how do we account for that? Is it possible that they can see that and not feel sorrow? Well, this story doesn't really lead to that. So it's just something we really don't know.
Yeah. And that's, I guess that's why all this stuff that you're bringing up, that's why I think it's a parable, but it gets across the idea that you're not going to be able to change, and it's going to be a place that's either going to be extremely pleasant or extremely unpleasant. I have a story I want to throw out there to you before we leave this. What about the story of King Saul summoning the spirit of Samuel back from the dead through the witch of Endor? Okay. So, I think we can safely assume that Samuel was in a place, was in paradise. Okay, and you remember Saul was getting ready to go up against the Philistines, and he realizes that they're in a terrible strait. And he's needing help, but he knows Samuel's already told him that God's not going to be with you. And so he's just doing everything. I mean, he's checked with the priest, with the Urim and Thummim, and he's not getting any answers, and there's no prophet talking to him. He's not having any dreams. He's not getting any help from God. And so he does the only thing he can think of. He goes to the witch of Endor, okay, to see if she's got something for him. And as you remember the story, Samuel comes up from the dead and speaks to him. And he basically says, why are you disturbing me? Why are you disturbing my rest? I'm just kind of paraphrasing, but that's kind of the way it went. Why are you disturbing my rest? And he, Saul, he's all scared, and he says, well, I need your help. I need to know what. He goes, I've already told you all that stuff. Why are you disturbing me now? You're going to die, your sons are going to die, and you're going to be defeated. That's that. And of course, after this little incident, he basically was so afraid that he was laying there practically dead, and the witch of Endor went out and killed her fatted lamb and said, you need to eat something. You got to get your strength. You got to get out of here. You know. Well, but here's my question. So, where was Samuel, and how did Samuel come back to talk to? How did Samuel come back and talk to Saul, who is a person alive and well on this earth? And go ahead, Dwayne.
The communication system was quite a bit different back then than it is now. God communicated with people and allowed more communication between the spiritual and the physical world back in the Old Testament time. So, yeah. You know, I don't have any explanation for it. But
well, the verse that really gets me. This is 1 Samuel 28:19. It says, moreover, the Lord will give Israel also with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons shall be with me. The Lord will give the army of Israel also into the hands of the Philistines. But he says, tomorrow your sons and you will be with me. Wow. Yeah,
exactly. I'm
assuming it means that you're going to be with me and Sheol. Okay, not specifically you're going to be with me in paradise, because we're assuming that we know Samuel was a very good prophet of God, and I'm assuming that when he went to Sheol, that he was on the side of the gulf, the great divide that is paradise, and I'm not going to make a judgment for. Well, maybe I shouldn't make a judgment for him either, but we just know that Saul was just gave up on God. You know, he was so tied up in this world's goods and things that He was just very unfaithful character in the Bible. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts that you want to offer on that little story, but I thought, well, if we're talking about Hades, we got to kind of look at that story there.
I think God just used that witch to speak to Saul and allowed her to do what she did as a medium, you know, which she apparently was.
You're thinking maybe that Samuel didn't necessarily come up from the dead at all, that it was actually... Here's one thing I read, that these mediums actually were... A lot of them were ventriloquists, and they could actually speak, you know, and make it sound like somebody's talking to them from the dead. Okay.
How do you compare that story to the Mount of Transfiguration as Moses and Elijah?
There you go. Yeah. There's another instance that we can talk about that these people came back.
Well, their spirit came back.
Their spirit, yes. That's what I'm talking about. We're talking about the spirits.
Form of a spiritual body as well that was able to be identified and recognized. And we're told as Christians that in like manner we will receive a heavenly body, and it calls it a body, as Christ has received. So I think we need to be careful just about how much we separate the physical body from the spiritual body. We will have a spiritual body in heaven.
Yeah,
what it looks like, how God will make it, we don't know, but it will be a spiritual body.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit more detailed about this resurrection of the body, but in 1 Corinthians 15th chapter, we're going to talk about how that the body is brought back together with the spirit. So that's going to happen, but I think that's something that happens in the very, very end of all things. Other supporting verses that we can, and we're running out of time. 2 Corinthians 12, 2 through 4. Here's something for you to think about. Paul's talking about a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up into third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body. He says, I don't know. God knows. And he says, I know that this man was caught up into paradise. Okay. Revelations 2 and 7, it says, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. Okay, and in paradise, defined by the Persian, or is a Persian word, or Persian origin, is used in the Septuagint as also as the translation of Eden. It means an orchard or of pleasure and fruits. In other words, a garden or a pleasure ground. Something like the English park. 2 Corinthians 5th chapter, verse 6 through 9, Paul says this. He says, so we are always of good courage. We know that while we're at home in the body, we are away from the Lord, for we walk by faith and not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. Okay, well, where's the Lord at? Well, don't we say the Lord is on the right hand of God in heaven? Okay, so that's another thing to think about. So we talk about this waiting place being paradise, and we know that Jesus went there, but is Jesus still in paradise? Well, no, he's in heaven. Okay, so now we have the question, is it to be with Christ? When he says to be with Christ, is that the meaning, the paradise side of Hades? Is that what it's talking about? Is it talking about just a general being in a place blessed by the Lord? Okay, these are things that we need to consider. We're out of time, and we might take a few minutes next week to kind of shore this up, but I do appreciate